You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the artificial pancreas was first described in a medical journal in 1972. Now, researchers say they may have an FDA-approved model on the market as soon as the end of next year. We'll talk about the development of an artificial pancreas and how it could help people with diabetes. Coming up.
Now, a new poll from the Wisconsin Professional Police Association shows that 80% of people in Wisconsin are happy with the work police do in their communities.
That number is higher than the national average. New data comes after a 2015 Gallup poll showed that approval of the police nationwide is actually at its lowest in 22 years.
Here to tell us more about the poll is Jim Palmer. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, welcome back.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you, the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, conducted the survey yourself. Why did you choose to get your own numbers?
Well, this is actually part of a multi-year effort. This is the fourth year in a row that we've done a poll. In each year, we've contracted with the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute because we really want to have a good sense of where the community is on a variety of law enforcement issues, how they feel about their police officers in this state and the job that they're doing, and to try and get them to weigh in on issues like body cameras and use of force and things of that nature. And it's worth noting that as far as we can tell, we're the only police group actually in the entire country that engages in an effort like this.
Now, the poll says that, at least one takeaway of the poll is that 80% of Wisconsinites are happy with the way the work that the police does in their community. What does that number say to you?
Well, to us, that's a very positive number. In the 4 years that we've been doing the poll, it has been high each year, despite the fact that this has been a very challenging environment and climate for the last few years for police officers, and they've been under a great deal of scrutiny, largely from media themes that have emerged from the national news. And so, each year we've kind of expected to see more of an impact of that, and we've been fortunately gratified that hasn't been the case. And I think it's largely due to the professionalism of the officers in this state, and hopefully to some extent, also reflective of our efforts as the state's largest law enforcement group to really keep a community-wide, statewide dialogue going on these things, and try to sustain a discourse in a way that we're not seeing anywhere else around the country.
And what work are you referring to specifically when we talk about the community being happy with the work the police force does?
We asked basically for the respondents' general approval ratings, but we also asked a number of questions about community policing, which we generally defined. And it's clear that that one issue that clearly crosses all demographic bounds is the value that Wisconsinites play on community policing, and in particular, according to our poll, members of the minority communities want more community policing. And that does stand in stark contrast to some of the things we've heard over the last few years about minorities wanting fewer officers or less of a police presence in their neighborhoods. Our poll strongly rebuts that.
Are there other polls nationwide that fly in the face of that number?
When it comes to, no, we're not aware of any polling that's been done on that specific issue. We came up with that question in response to some assertions that were made publicly within the last 2 years in the Madison area predominantly, and we really wanted to test that. As you may recall, Madison Police Chief Mike Koval had responded to those assertions that when they were made about, I think it was at the end of 2014, early 2015, by saying that that wasn't what he was hearing in the neighborhoods and meeting the community groups and the neighborhood associations. That he wasn't hearing that they wanted less of a police presence. In fact, he was hearing that they wanted more. But that was really anecdotal, and so we really wanted to see if we could drill down through the use of this statewide poll and see if we could get another measure.
Did you break down that first number that we're talking about at all by race and ethnic group?
We did. We really did want to drill down by that, and we think it's an important thing to talk about. It's clear that Caucasians, according to our poll, 83% of them approve of the job of their local police officers, and minorities, it's still a strong approval rating or positive approval rating, but it's much less at 59%. And I think that's an important distinction to highlight because I think there are some who might otherwise try to undermine or diminish those assertions when they're made about how minorities feel about law enforcement officers, and clearly there's proof of that in our poll. We think that's you know, an important recognition and awareness that needs to take place in order for us to move forward and figure out how to bridge that gap.
How does that compare with numbers from the last couple of years?
From the last couple of years, there hasn't been a huge change in that specifically. But this was the first year we really wanted to drill down on the demographics and get more of a historical perspective. And that's something that we hadn't done in the past. And each and every year, you know, we're looking for ways to improve our poll and improve the questions that we ask and make them more relevant. And again, you know, we really view this as a vehicle to, you know, sustain a community-wide, statewide dialogue on issues involving race and law enforcement and a variety of other law enforcement-related matters.
We're talking with Jim Palmer right now, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, talking about a new poll gauging attitudes toward police by the community. And as we know, there has been, you know, as we were talking about, a lot of change in the last couple of years in the way people are thinking about the police. And at least there's been a rethinking of how police should best interact with the different communities that they serve. And how will you use this to go forward and try to make some of those changes or decide what's working and what's not working?
Well, certainly, I think it reflects, you know, two strong themes in particular. One, that as it relates to community policing, and there has been a growth over the last 20 years of community policing throughout the country, but as it relates to community policing in Wisconsin, that's, again, as I mentioned, something that the support for that crosses all demographic bounds, and that's really where I think law enforcement agencies would be best served by, you know, reconcentrating and refocusing and redoubling their efforts in that regard. And the other thing I think it shows is that in a lot of respects, or at least I hope it shows, is that the law enforcement community here in Wisconsin is ahead of the curve when it comes to how we approach these issues. And, you know, a good example of that is the fact, as you may well recall, that in 2014, Wisconsin was the first state in the nation to adopt a law that requires every officer-related death to be independently investigated and in a very transparent manner. And we were the first in the nation to do that. And even since Ferguson and Baltimore, and in fact, Wisconsin's law came before those two incidents. But since then, only two other states in the nation, Connecticut and Illinois, have established laws that are even similar to that. And we think that you know, the law enforcement community as a national whole would be best served by putting more of these accountability measures in place.
One other finding in the poll that we haven't talked about yet, it sounds as though it's getting more difficult to recruit people to join the force, to want to become police officers. What do you make of that?
Well, there does seem to be a sense of that, and we just conducted a recent survey amongst our members, and we haven't yet tabulated that, but there does seem to be a strong anecdotal sense that law enforcement agencies are having a much, much more difficult time recruiting new officers, and we're not sure if that's because of the things they're seeing in the news, or the scrutiny, or the fact that, you know, right now, as far as this year is concerned, you know, officer-involved deaths by shootings are up 113%. You know, we're not sure what's contributing to that, but clearly there does seem to be some strong anecdotal evidence that recruiting is taking a hit, and that's something that should concern every citizen of this state, and certainly it's something that we think is important to talk about.
And another question here, asking respondents if they believe that police shoot unarmed people. 68% thought that they did, and the report notes that it finds in reality 91% of the police shoots are armed. And I know the numbers can be difficult about this. Gathering data as a whole nationally has been difficult. How confident are you in those numbers?
Well, we're very confident. In fact, our numbers are absolutely on the mark with the Washington Post, and maybe this is a sad reflection of the times in which we're in, but the Washington Post to date is the best national database for the number of officer-related deaths. And by both their numbers and ours, they were identical. Every individual who was shot and killed last year by a Wisconsin police officer, every individual but one, was armed. And that number comes down to 91%. And, you know, 68% in varying degrees of the public, according to our poll, think that police officers shoot unarmed individuals. In particular, minorities, about 44% of them, according to our poll, seem to think that unarmed individuals are getting shot. And so we think, again, that's something, that's why we do a poll. We want to test the perceptions, and then we want to, you know, match that up with the reality that we know from the statistics and be able to talk about those. And I think it's hopefully we're contributing to the public discourse in a constructive way.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. He told us about a new poll that found that 80% of people in Wisconsin are happy with their police force. 73% of minorities want more community policing. If you know someone with type 1 diabetes, you know how difficult it can be to determine how much insulin is needed at any given moment. Researchers have been talking about a possible solution since 1972, an artificial pancreas.
Dan Hurley just covered the race to create an FDA-approved artificial pancreas for Discover Magazine. He's with us now to talk about it. He's a contributor to Discover and the author of Diabetes Rising. Also writes for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, and the Atlantic. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk us through what would change for someone with type 1 diabetes from what they have to do now to manage insulin to what potentially an artificial pancreas could do for them.
So when people hear the word artificial pancreas, I think a lot of folks are assuming that it's like a biological device, like some sort of organ. It's not. It's taking two existing pieces of technology, insulin pumps, which have existed since the 1980s, and what's called a continuous glucose monitor, which is something that you put this thing that goes about half an inch under your skin, and you just keep it in for a few days, and it sends a signal to a little device that tells you what your glucose level is. So this is really great for people with type 1 because their glucose level, you know, they eat, it goes up, they take insulin, it goes down, and it's very hard to predict it and understand it. I've had diabetes. I developed type 1 diabetes in Wisconsin when I was at Beloit College in 1975, my first semester. And ever since, I've been watching this roller coaster go up and down and trying to control it. And the problem is it's just beyond the human ability to figure it all out, no matter how hard you try. And what this thing does is it takes the information from the sensor and it figures out an algorithm based on, you know, your previous history, and it figures out how much insulin do you need right now. And they've done studies after studies after studies that show, this works a lot better than a person trying to figure it out 24 hours a day, especially when they're asleep
right.
or jogging or something, or having a life. And it gives you this really great control. It's not as good as having, you know, not having diabetes, but it's a lot better than anyone can do on their own.
Right. So your life right now and the lives of people with type 1 diabetes is you're constantly poking yourself, right, for a blood test. And it's this eternally
yes.
moving target. You test, modify the insulin, take insulin, test, take insulin. This is doing that. This is tracking that moving target for you while it's running.
It absolutely is. It's controlling the pump on its own. It's totally automated. Perhaps you have to click in that you've had a small meal or a big meal or an average meal. Perhaps you click in that you're going to exercise, but it otherwise is figuring out everything on its own. And as we all know with our smartphones, computers are really good at figuring this kind of stuff out, of making estimates and seeing trend lines. And it's working 24 hours a day. So it's an incredible breakthrough that has gone now from academics talking about it to companies racing to bring the first one out in the next few years.
And Dan, we'll get into that race to get these things on the market, but let's go to those early studies. This, you mentioned you were first diagnosed in 1975. This idea of an external sort of artificial pancreas was floated 3 years before that, 1972. Are we here, four decades plus later, just now on the cusp of getting these things into practice?
Because, first of all, it's a really tough problem. So in 75, the only way you could test your blood sugar was go into a doctor's office and get a blood test. You couldn't do the finger prick thing. And they only came out with that around 1980. I mean, I remember when my roommate came home and said, hey, here's this thing. You can test your own blood sugar at home. I was like, what? And so that transformed people's lives. But then they had about past 10 years, they've had something called a continuous glucose monitor, which I can look at a thing smaller than a cell phone, and it will tell me what my, show me trend lines of where my sugar is going. But the FDA was very afraid of this and very concerned about this idea of automatically dispensing a drug that can kill you. I mean, take too much insulin, you'll get a low blood sugar, and you can die. So the FDA was very nervous about it, and it really took the leadership of JDRF, formerly known as the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, to essentially wrestle down the FDA and manufacturers and bring them together and say, we need something on the market, and this is what's finally about to come out.
Talking to science writer Dan Hurley, his piece in Discover Magazine looks at the race to create an artificial pancreas, like a cell phone-sized device that, for people with type 1 diabetes, measures their glucose levels and dispenses insulin as needed. Dan, some of the people, some of the players you profile in this are really motivated because they have either themselves or kids who have type 1 diabetes. How is that factored into the impetus for the entrepreneurs getting into this?
Absolutely. And I mean, the guy who, the recent past president of JDRF, his son had type 1, and that's why he got involved. And he was a entrepreneur in internet in the 1990s when everything was first really starting. And when his kid developed type 1, he said, hey, why aren't computers helping people manage their diabetes? And he ended up becoming president of JDRF, and a little over a year ago he left JDRF to start a company to bring this to market, because he was still frustrated at the slow pace. Another guy that's really well known and has been in the press a lot, Ed Damiano up in Boston, his son also has type 1 diabetes, and he's publicly declared his intent to have one of these devices available by the time his son goes to college.
Do we know how many companies there are like this and inventors trying to get one of these things on the market?
So Medtronic is the big company. They dominate the diabetes technology space. And they have been moving rather slowly, but they've just completed what's called a pivotal trial big enough to convince the FDA. And they're going to do another larger trial, and they say that they believe they can have a product out by the end of next year. Now, a lot of folks think that their product is going to be not as fully capable as what people with type 1 really want. So Ed Damiano is trying to bring a product, but he's affiliated with a company, but he thinks it can be done, by academics. Bigfoot Medical has gone all in, and they're a new company run by three great technology people, and they likewise say they think they can bring something out by early 2018. So it's after decades of hearing this stuff, of one day in the next 10 years, blah, blah. It's just about ready for prime time.
And in the meantime, you write, some people not willing to wait for that, some people, and don't try this at home, I guess, have hacked their own versions of this. They've invented their own for personal use.
So what's really funny is the guy who developed the computer algorithm that is going to run the machine for Bigfoot Medical. A year and a half ago, I interviewed him when nobody, he was a nothing more than a rumor that some guy had created one for his son. And people were, you know, the diabetes community was gossiping about this. And, you know, was it real and who was it? And nobody knew. And I wrote an article for Wired saying, you know, that the guy was like Bigfoot. You know, he's rumored but never seen. Well, it turns out now he's joined this company to bring a product to market. He did do it not only for his son but also for his wife, who also has type 1, and they named their company after the line that, you know, I offhandedly said he's like Bigfoot. They named their company Bigfoot Medical.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Dan Hurley, contributor to Discover, author of Diabetes Rising, talking about the effort to create an artificial pancreas for diabetes sufferers.
The results of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, also known as the Nation's Report Card, came out yesterday and found that high school seniors are slipping in math skills and their reading scores are flat. According to the report, only about a third of high school seniors are ready for college-level math and reading courses.
That report also comes as high school graduation rates remain at a high level here in Wisconsin and around the nation. The Department of Public Instruction said today that the most recent graduation rate in Wisconsin is at 88.4%, well above the national average.
Morgan Polakoff joins us now. He's Associate Professor of Education at the University of Southern California, Rossier School of Education. Morgan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
And joining us now in the studio is Peter Goff, Assistant Professor of Education Policy at UW-Madison. Peter, thanks for coming up.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, Morgan, we're going to start with you. Why are these numbers so important that just came out yesterday from the so-called Nation's Report Card?
Well, the NAEP exam is really the only exam that gives us a good sense across the entire nation of aggregate trends in performance. And so every couple of years we get these results for 4th and 8th grade and for 12th grade, and they give us a sense of overall whether students are sort of headed in the right direction or not. I think that they show again that there's some challenges in terms of raising the performance at the high school level. But we've seen over the years that there's been a great deal of performance at the lower grades levels of 4 and 8. So I think it raises a lot of questions about, why we're not seeing success persisting to those higher grades. And taken in concert with the graduation rate data that you just mentioned that shows that graduation rates in most states are at or near all-time highs, it certainly raises some questions about how well prepared those graduating students will be for success in college and career.
What do we know about what it means to be prepared for success in college and career?
Well, that is a very broad question. I mean, I think that we know that certainly academic readiness of our students is not where it needs to be. We have evidence from NAEP of that, and we have evidence also from other assessments, such as the ACT and the SAT, that on average students, frankly, just don't do that well at the end of high school in terms of their knowledge. But, of course, there are other things that play into readiness. I think most folks agree that knowledge, particularly as shown on these kind of assessments, is an important but relatively limited measure of readiness. So, in fact, we know things like non-cognitive habits of mind, perseverance, grit, those kinds of things clearly also matter for success. And frankly, at a more basic level, the ability to engage and interact with people, to be part of a team, those are kinds of things that are not well measured by national assessments, but that clearly matter for student success. So I think everyone would agree that these tests are one piece of a much larger puzzle of readiness.
I guess the big question that we're getting at with all of this is, what does it say when the graduation rate nationally is 81, 82%, but these NAEP test results are something like 37, 38. So what do you make of that in-between area? It seems as though there's a disparity there.
Well, there is certainly a disparity. I mean, one important thing to note is that the NAEP definition of proficiency is a very high definition of proficiency. So it's most people would say that, most people who study this issue would say that the NAEP proficiency definition does not necessarily mean on grade level, but it really means a very high level of performance. So the fact that the number is 33% on NAEP or something like that versus a graduation rate of 88%, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, 55% of people shouldn't be graduating high school. It certainly doesn't mean that.
So you're saying the 37 NAEP score is pretty high then? It's not as low as it sounds?
Well, I mean, I'm not saying it's pretty high either, but I am saying it's not as low as it sounds, because the NAEP definition of proficiency is a high definition of proficiency. And so when you look at performance on state assessments, for instance, Wisconsin gives a state assessment. I don't happen to know what it's called, but every state gives an assessment under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. The proficiency rates on those assessments tend to be somewhat higher, and it's not obvious that there is a, quote, right answer as to which proficiency definition is the right one. But, you know, we can sort of triangulate from NAEP, from the ACT. They have their own college readiness criteria, and the SAT does as well. And we can sort of triangulate and get an estimate of what proportion of students really are ready for success. And it's certainly, no one would say that all of the 88% of students who graduate high school are ready for success in college. We know that that's not true, because large percents of those students need remediation when they get to college.
We're looking at levels of college readiness and high school graduation rates right now with Morgan Polakoff from the University of Southern California. Also with us in the studio, Peter Goff from UW-Madison, professor of education policy. And Peter, we're going to bring you in on this now. So let's look at Wisconsin. The Department of Public Instruction said that the 2015 high school graduation rate is 88.4% higher than the national average. So how do you take that news? Is it good?
Well, the graduation rate is a tricky bar, in part because it's manipulable by the schools themselves. Schools tend to be held accountable for graduation rates, so they can do things to move to graduate students without actually increasing achievement. That's not to say that's what's happening. I think Wisconsin has put a lot into place to help students graduate, and a lot of the gains that we see here we should be very proud of. For example, we have over the last several years, we have a new dropout system, the DUES system, dropout early warning, that's put systems into place to support students that are at risk so they can get the services and supports that they need. But one of the troubling things that I find about the graduation rates in Wisconsin is the achievement gap between Black students and white students. And this is, from a policy standpoint, we tend to quibble about, you know, is this a significant difference or not? And the graduation rate is really astonishingly large. So that of that 88% you mentioned, white students have a graduation rate of 93%, and African-American students are at 66%. So they lag far, far behind. And that's not something that's new with this round of data. That's been consistent over the last several years.
And how does that particular number, that gap, compare nationally?
The gap is largest in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has the largest gaps by almost any measure. So if we're looking at the NAEP scores that Morgan was talking about earlier, we see the gaps in Wisconsin are large there in literacy, across grades, in mathematics, in graduation, by almost any measure. And even when we look into post-secondary, so of the students that are graduating, we see lower rates of college going, and then lower rates of college completion as well.
And so looking at that achievement gap in Wisconsin, do you see any good news in these numbers, any sort of movement that would indicate the momentum one way or the other?
Possibly. We see some increase in the Hispanic students in Wisconsin, that they seem to be improving. But the gains don't seem to be making their way to the students, the lowest income students that need it the most.
You're a policy guy at UW-Madison. What sorts of tools are being tried here in Wisconsin to help to close the achievement gap in terms of yearly school performance and in that graduation rate?
So as I mentioned, the DUE system, the dropout warning system, is one of the strategies that's being tried. There's, unfortunately, with the achievement gap, as we look both in Wisconsin and nationally, there's no easy answers. There's not a silver bullet, something that we can easily point our finger at. And with education, the challenges are much broader than the institution itself, and we need to think about ways that looking beyond just education in terms of both housing, employment, the economic system as a whole within the state, integrating those seems to be the best strategy to reduce that, but those are really big challenges.
I want to ask both you and Morgan, are there any interventions that seem to be effective in terms of, say, for instance, spending per student? Is there any correlation between higher graduation rates and spending more per money per pupil?
Well, higher spending districts do have higher graduation rates, but that's primarily tied to socioeconomic status. These tend to be more affluent students in general. But that's not to say spending doesn't matter. We've seen drastic cuts in education spending in Wisconsin. The governor's voucher plan, for example, funds vouchers by pulling money out of the equalization aid that goes to schools that is supposed to, that is intended to level the playing field. So I don't think between the cuts overall, the increase from the voucher program, I don't think we have anything in place, any help coming from this state that's going to remediate these sort of inequities.
And Morgan, same story nationally?
Yeah, so there's a good deal of recent research that suggests that court-ordered school finance reforms actually can have substantial positive impacts on student outcomes. I think that what I would say is that in general, with those kinds of reforms and actually with really any kind of policy, unless they're targeted at closing gaps or targeted at particular groups, then they're much likelier to sort of raise overall levels of performance than they are to help address those enormous gaps in access and outcomes that Peter mentioned, which hold not just in Wisconsin. I mean, he's right that they are largest in Wisconsin, but they hold nationally as well.
We're talking with Morgan Polakoff right now, Associate Professor of Education at the University of Southern California, Rossier School of Education. Also joining us in studio is Peter Goff, Assistant Professor of Education Policy at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the nation's report card, which says that only about a third of high school seniors are ready for college math and reading courses, even though the country's graduation rates are at a high level.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our high school is setting a high enough standard, a high enough bar for high school students by the time they graduate. Do you feel like graduates are prepared for college-level courses or the workforce? Have you seen this as a student yourself, a parent, maybe as an employer? And what would it take to close the racial achievement gap here in Wisconsin schools? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you see those disparities in your own community? Call in 800-642-1234.
We're picking up our conversation now with Morgan Polakoff, Associate Professor of Education at the University of Southern California, Rossier School of Education. And Peter Goff is with us. He's an Assistant Professor of Education Policy at UW-Madison.
Looking at the new nation's report card results, finding only about a third of high school seniors, they say, are ready for college. Meanwhile, Wisconsin, new numbers out, pretty good graduation rates, but as our guests point out, still a high racial disparity pretty much any way you measure it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are kids coming out of high school ready for the workforce, for college? Were you, if you just graduated recently? And what would it take to close the racial achievement gap here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Julie on the line in Stevens Point. Julie, hi.
My comment has to do with your question, which was, are the kids ready once they get out of high school? And though our graduation rates are, you know, braced and everything, I have to say, no, I'm not seeing it. Not because they don't necessarily know the academics, but the work ethic just isn't there. I feel like the trend in education right now is letting the kids turn in work whenever they want, accepting, you know, retake after retake, and not for necessarily valid reasons for traumatic events, just that, I didn't study or I didn't get to it. And I think that's a huge, huge thing. I think our academics are there, but we're fluffing them because we're not holding these kids to these high standards.
Julie, thanks a lot for that call. And Peter, what do you say to that? I mean, it's in the school's interest to graduate students. It's in the students' interest to graduate. But when they emerge from high school, are they ready in college or for the workforce these days?
Well, I think there's been substantial challenges to getting students into college. There's been a huge push nationally to have students be college ready and for every student to have a college education, or at least the opportunity to have a college education. So when a student does drop out, their chances of then going on to college, even if they have the exact same skill set as a student who graduates, is far, far lower. So the fact that we can help students persevere to that level and then their chances of success later on increase, they may not be ready right off the bat. And as the caller mentioned, I think there actually has been a focus of late. Morgan mentioned these sort of non-cognitive skills that folks have been pushing, the perseverance, grit, especially in the high need context, has been a huge component of post-secondary success for many students. So I do think that's an emphasis, but it could be a larger emphasis could be made nationally.
And Morgan, what is your take?
Well, I would echo what Peter just said. There is increased policy focus on these kinds of non-test-based outcomes, and the new reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is called ESSA, gives states a lot more opportunity to think about and use different kinds of measures in their school evaluation systems. And I think that there's likely to be a number of states that take up these measures and really start to investigate more seriously the extent to which schools are preparing students, not just in terms of academics, but also in terms of these other outcomes that we know matter for student success.
Now, Peter, you used the word grit, and that's become a very hot term in education fields, this idea about perseverance being just as important as other qualities. Is there too much trendiness to that word? Is there data to back that up, that actually this does help students when they get out there?
Sure. There's. Is there too much trendiness to it? Yeah, absolutely. Anything that gets to the point where it becomes a fad tends to be a little bit overblown. And again, people turn to that as the silver bullet at the exclusion of other things. But at the end of the day, the fact that we're moving towards a more growth mindset, this idea that, you know, we're not telling kids that they're smart, we're rewarding their effort. And that's what we find across sectors, across genders, across race, that seems to make the difference between the kids that give up and shut down and the kids that keep pushing when the time gets tough. And that's how they acquire the skills as they move through the curriculum. So obviously, and I think the caller would agree with the statement that it's not to the exclusion of everything else. We don't want perseverance. We don't want to reward their effort at the expense of what they actually did with that effort, what they actually produced. But nonetheless, the evidence seems to be moving in a fairly compelling way to suggest that it's these non-cognitive skills that really push throughout success.
Let's get another call in. Now we've got Tyler on the line in Eau Claire. Hi, Tyler.
Hey, yeah, so I'm starting my master's program soon, but when I transferred, you know, from the high school to college, I got D's on my first science exam because I just didn't know, you know, the level of curriculum, and it wasn't necessarily high school's fault at all. I had great teachers, but I kind of was able to coax through high school just fine, and I feel like that happens to a lot of students when they first enter college. They need to realize, you know, oh, this is a completely different level of education, and some students get distracted by, you know, certain things like partying and not having supervision from parents, and thus they kind of fall through the gaps.
Tyler, thanks a lot for those comments there. Tyler saying he was not prepared for the jump from high school to college. Some people have suggested something like a gap year, but is there some sort of agreed upon curriculum? The Common Core isn't exactly agreed upon anymore, but how do we know what does prepare kids for college? Peter?
Well, I think we've seen a change in the college system and what we think in terms of what what is college ready and what colleges can do to help students get into college and stay in college. And that's something that has a strong push and appeal from an equity standpoint. We want to reduce those barriers. We don't want high school to be the sort of cutoff that says you can't go to college, you don't have this degree, as opposed to something that says, this, you know, we will facilitate this process. And we do see a huge increase in the amount of schools, universities offering remediation classes. And some people will criticize that, saying we should have been doing this in high school. But I think at the end of the day, what we're seeing is these are access points. Students that may not have had access to these classes in high school at the level of rigor that they need, but they can get access to it in the universities.
I want to leave it there. Morgan and Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking there with Morgan Polakoff, Associate Professor of Education at the University of Southern California in the Rossier School of Education. Also joining us there, Peter Goff, Assistant Professor of Education Policy at UW-Madison. And they joined us for a look at educational achievement for the nation's high school seniors.